Welcome back to the Mark Claire Show. My guest today, he wears many hats, I guess you could say. He's a truth seeker, a researcher, a Christian. He is the proprietor of the website faithbyreason.net. He also runs the Faith by Reason channels on YouTube and Rumble. Very pleased to welcome Ed Mabry. Ed, welcome to my show.
Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate you having me on. So thanks so much.
Well, sure thing, Ed. And I think, you know, the crux of your work really addresses, I think, a lot of what I've run into in my own sort of religious and spiritual journeys, I guess you could say, is trying to bridge that gap from having a desire to have faith in some way, but also really having that part of the brain that needs the logic and the reasons and to show from point A to point B. And that really is the crux. I'll let you further describe what you were trying to do, but that's what really strikes me about your work. And we'll dive into that more in a bit. But first, I want to get to know you just a little bit better. So maybe you can just delve into your own background, whether that touches on your religious background and just kind of how you got onto the path that you're on now with Faith by Reason.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for that. So you pretty much hit the nail on the head. That's the crux of it. I was raised a Christian. You know, I was raised in the church, grew up in the church, but I've always had a very inquisitive mind. You know, as a child, I was always asking why. I mean, if you ask my parents what my first word was, they would say his first word was why. He was always asking questions. And so I would do it in the church. You know, I believed in God, believed in Jesus and all that. It was great. But I would ask questions because there were some things that, you know, in the Bible that I wouldn't say don't make sense necessarily, but you need some more explanation. So I would ask my pastors, you know, why did God flood the world and destroy everything if he's a God of love, or you know, how was Jesus born of a virgin if he didn't have a father?
That's one that always stood out to me. Yeah, that was a big question.
Yeah, and I'm happy to address it. As we go along, but you know, so I had lots of questions, and I think eventually the people in church, the pastors, just kind of got tired of hearing me always asking questions, and they said, you know what, it's not right to question God. I'm like, oh well, okay, well I don't want to make God angry, so I'll just stop asking questions. The problem is that when you don't ask questions, you don't get answers, and then you run into areas of your life where you actually need those questions answered. It was when I, you know, went to college. Went to a secular university, which, you know, most of them are. And when I got there, I just found that my fellow classmates, as well as my professors, just took great delight in deconstructing my faith and asking me really tough questions that, you know, should be answered and are honest questions, but I just wasn't prepared to answer them.
I presume they were coming at it from more of like the atheist point of view, trying to sort of debunk the faith.
Pretty much. Yeah. For example, I remember I wrote a paper for my anthropology class, and part of it, we had to use five references. And one of the references I used, because I was doing ancient Near Eastern culture in my anthropology class, and one of the resources I used was the Bible. And I thought I did a great job on the paper, but I ended up getting a B. And so I go to the professor afterwards and I say, you know, just curious, why did I get a B and not an A? And she said, well, because you used the Bible as one of your references. I'm like, well, what's wrong with that? She literally laughs in my face and says, you know, you can't use the Bible. It's unreliable. It's not historic. The God of the Bible, Jehovah of the Bible, is just the Jewish version of the old Canaanite vengeance gods. And she just, you know, and I had no response. I had never heard this before. You know, and my classmates would ask me questions like, you know, if God is loving, why do bad things happen? You know, the classic questions. And I didn't have good answers. And I just kind of got wrecked in college. And it sent me on a journey of trying to discover, does this really make sense? Now, I never stopped believing in God because the alternative was ludicrous. The entire secular, atheistic, evolutionary paradigm, it honestly makes no sense at all to me. It's actually unscientific. We can, you know, go in there if we want to, and I actually talk about that quite a bit on Faith by Reason. You know, the idea of life coming from non-life, of things going from chaos to order, which is the exact opposite of the second law of thermodynamics. So, you know, in order for evolution to be true, you have to actually violate several established scientific laws. So I'd never stopped believing in God, but what I stopped believing was what people said about God, what human beings say about him. So I wanted to really find out what was true. And going through those journeys, I looked at different religions, I looked at different faith systems, and I just got to the point where I said, look, God, if you are real, then you should make sense. You should make sense with logic and reason. I shouldn't have to believe in you blindly. And so my thought, my conversation, my prayer was basically make it make sense. And to his credit, he honored that. And I was led to information sources and to people, very, very smart people, Christians who were scientists, who were, you know, both Christians and scientists and engineers, who put me on a path of understanding that not only does the Judeo-Christian philosophy make sense, but it makes more sense than the other philosophies. And that brought me back to it. And so the reason for I got Faith by Reason going was because I knew I wasn't the only person on this journey. I knew there were other Christians who were, like me, educated, systems thinkers, logical thinkers, who just wanted things to make sense and wanted to understand the Bible and understand God and understand Christian philosophy in a way that is, that uses the ideas of logic, reason, systematic analysis. And that's what I do. So I start from the beginning. When you go to Faith by Reason, there's a start here button. And if you go there, you'll see that I don't even start by presuming God. I start by the basic human question that we all have, which is, why are we here? What's the meaning of life? What's the point of existence? And I just go from there and in a very logical and systematic analysis, go from who are we, why are we here, to what faith and spirituality is, and all the way through.
All right. There's a number of directions we can go in here, but I find it really interesting that this sort of particular part of your journey, in a way you could say, started with an act of faith of sorts, that's very specific prayer to have it all make sense. And so I'm curious, like, after you made that sort of very specific call to God, did you start to see like very specific people or signs appear around you that told you like, okay, he's answering my call here?
To a degree, yeah. I wouldn't say signs in the mystical sense. I would say I was put in touch with people, or I found people who did make it make sense. For example, I remember I lived in Southern California at the time, and I was commuting. I had a pretty long commute to work. And so I got tired of hearing all the, you know, music stations where they played the same five songs over and over again. So I went to a Christian station, which I normally didn't really go to, because I just thought a lot of it was frankly BS. A lot of these, you know, so-called these pastors, you know, spewing their stuff, asking you for money all the time. Mm-hmm. But I happened upon a show from a man named Chuck Missler, who passed away a few years ago, but he was a systems engineer in Silicon Valley, went to the Naval Academy, very, very smart guy. And he was doing a series on the, he called Beyond Perception, using quantum physics to help us understand how, you know, God could have spoken reality into existence. And I was fascinated by it. And when I started studying his work and buying his materials, that led me to another guy named Lambert Dolphin, who did some very similar things, very scientific, systematic thinker. And then that led me to Dr. Mark Eastman, who is a medical doctor, and he did a whole series on evolution and just completely debunking it in a way that just made total logical sense. And those are the kinds of people I ran into. And then I said fairly recently, about 10 years ago, I happened to hear another person on radio by the name of John Linhart, who's become a personal friend of mine, who has a book called Modeling God, where he's a chemist, and he used his technique of modeling to basically not put God into a model, but basically model the aspects of God in a very, very scientific way. And it was brilliant. And I contacted him. He and I have become friends. He's also fantastic in psychology, helping us understand how our minds work and how they reflect the mind of God. And it's just been amazing stuff. And as I said, my father, who's actually a pastor, when I was talking to him about all the things I've learned, he said, you know, here's the thing. You don't want to be a reservoir. You want to be a river. A reservoir just holds material. You want to be a river and let it run through you and let what you've learned help other people. And so that's been my thing since.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there are so many people that do get obsessed with, go down whatever it may be, whether it's a rabbit hole about religion or conspiracy rabbit hole, and they do become that reservoir. They just maybe sit there and just absorb, but what are you doing with it, you know? And depending on what that information is, it could even be harmful for you to sort of become a reservoir of certain information. So I think that way to look at it is a good one, to sort of be that river, let it flow through you, but then how do you direct it from there? So that's how you see your role in this. The information, if it's true, if it's real, if you're finding all these people that are also on the same journey that you were seeking, that are actually trying to make sense of the universe, of the world we have through the context of God, then, you know, you can just be that, you know, one little branch of that river that other people might find. And, you know, if we continue that river analogy, might, you know, dip their toe in someday and, you know, go down their own path.
Right. And so I really, as I said, I wanted to, I didn't want to be overly dogmatic because that's not attractive to me. I don't like people who just say, this is the way it is. And you either believe me or, you know, or you're wrong. Because I've learned things over the years that, you know, that have altered what I believe. I mean, if you were asked things I believed 10 years ago, many of them I don't believe now. So I always say on Faith by Reason, hey, this is my opinion. I could be wrong here. But I'm going to give you the reasons why I came to these conclusions. And if you dispute them, great. I want to hear about it. Because no matter what happens, you can always have a profitable interaction with someone, whether no matter who's right or wrong. For example, if I'm right and you're wrong, you get to learn from me. If you're right and I'm wrong, I get to learn from you. So each interaction can be profitable. And that's the way I look at it. It's called contrastive thinking. You know, and that's what humility is. You know, the Bible talks about pride and humility, and God hates pride. Why does God hate pride? Because pride is what's called comparative thinking. Comparative thinking is where you're trying to prove yourself right. And if you're always trying to prove yourself right, then you're never open to being wrong. But if you're a contrastive thinker, if you're always trying, if you know, you're going to take a position, but you say, you know what, I want to see if I can prove my position wrong. And if I can prove myself wrong, then that means, great, I have the opportunity now to be more right. So I'm always questioning everything that I believe, because that's the only way you can get more right is to try to prove yourself wrong.
Well, let's go back to that professor you had earlier that you mentioned. Sure. That wanted to sort of give you, I mean, you still got a B at least. I guess she could have failed you or something. But, you know, she kind of poo-pooed the fact that you're using the Bible as a source. And I have a lot of people, right, I think, in my life, many of which are more of what you might call the systems engineer type people, who would probably say something similar. They would say, well, these are just, you know, the writings of an ancient people, probably similar to some of what she was saying. Like, they're just regurgitating some of the older gods they had, and you can't really call that a historical source. So why don't we go back to that? Why would you say that that's not true, that it is something we can look at as a reliable source of information in some way? Maybe people are looking at it in the wrong way.
Yeah. So if someone were to say to me, you know, the Bible isn't reliable, well, then my first question would be, okay, by what standards are you using? And they'll give several, I mean, I guess I'm answering for them, but some of the objections that I've gotten is, well, you know, the Bible is written by men. So how do we know it's real? Well, here's the thing. You don't hold any other text to that same level of criticism.
That's every other book, right?
Right. Your high school math book was written by men. Do you not believe in math because it was written by men? Well, then we'll know, but I can prove math. Same thing with the Bible. You can actually use that as any other source of literature. You can look at it and say, does it match reality? That's really what it comes down to. Does it match reality? And we can get into some quantum stuff, but for one thing that I'd like to tell people, because this is something I've been studying very recently, is what is the universe made of? How does the universe come into being? Well, you have, you know, if you want to go with the atheist versus Christian view, the atheistic view is that, you know, there was an explosion of some kind, whether it be the Big Bang, a singularity, some chaotic explosion, and then over time, things became ordered. Okay, well, the Christian point of view, or the Judeo-Christian point of view, the biblical point of view is it started with intelligence and it was ordered from the start. And now over time, things are becoming more chaotic. Mm-hmm. Which one matches reality? Which one matches actual science? Well, actual science, the second law of thermodynamics, states that things go from order to chaos, not chaos to order. So which one makes more sense? What is the universe made of? How did it come into being? Well, when you get down again to the quantum level, we have, you know, protons, neutrons, and electrons. They make up the atom, which is, you know, the building block of all of our material existence. The electron is, it's basically that. It's a packet of electricity. It's energy. The protons and the neutrons, when you get down to what they're made of quarks. Quarks are vibrations. So the fundamental things that make up our universe is energy and vibrations, but ordered vibrations, because our universe is very orderly from the subatomic level all the way up to the macro level, to stars and planets. Things are orderly. So you have an ordered energy and ordered vibrations. What's an ordered vibration? Vibrations are sound. An ordered vibration would be words. Words, songs, music. That's ordered vibrations. Well, again, the Judeo-Christian philosophy says that God spoke the universe into existence. with speaking, words ordered vibrations, and there was energy, there was light. Light and vibrations is what the universe is made of. The Judeo-Christian philosophy says that the universe was made up of energy and ordered vibration in words. The secular point of view says that it was chaos. Which one matches reality? I would dare say that the Judeo-Christian worldview and that creation narrative is far closer to reality than the secular worldview. So I would start with that. And then when you talk about, you know, are the books of the Bible reliable? And you'll hear people say things like, oh, well, the Bible's been altered and changed over the years. Okay, let's say it has been. How do you prove it? Well, how do you prove anything is a counterfeit? Let's say, Mark, you say you gave me $100 and I had to pay you back. And I gave you a $100 bill, but instead of Benjamin Franklin's picture on it, you have Joe Biden's picture on it. You say, Ed, you just gave me a counterfeit $100 bill. And I say, oh, no, this was a real $100 bill. We go to court. How do you prove that my $100 bill is a counterfeit?
In this example, it's pretty easy. Yeah, you produce a real one and show them that there's no Joe Biden on the real one, and you're good to go,
right?
Probably. Yeah.
Same thing with the Bible. If you want to show me how it was altered, show me the original and show me how the current version is altered. Well, it actually happens that we do have some original texts, or as close to the original as we can get. We have things like the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are dated a couple of centuries BC, and it has fragments of just about every book in the Bible, including a complete portion of the book of Isaiah. And when you compare that to our current book of Isaiah, they were virtually identical. There were some, you know, grammatical things here and there and some punctuation kind of things, but it was almost the same. So that shows that the Old Testament at least has not been altered anywhere to the degree that people claim. And then when you have some of the books of the New Testament, there are many of the copies that are dated to the first century. There are over 2,000 copies of the book of Matthew that were dated in the first century. So has it been altered? If it has, not very much. And here's the other thing is that we have so many copies of it, then we have, if there are some differences, and there have been, when you copy something, there are going to be differences, but we have access to so many of those different copies that, you know, scholars do textual criticism, which is a whole school of thought, where they've done that kind of criticism, textual criticism, and they found that the Bible's pretty darn reliable. It's one of the more reliable of the ancient documents that we have, more reliable than the Gaelic Wars by Caesar, more reliable than our copies of the Iliad by Homer. Mm-hmm. So all that to say, as I said before, if you want to dispute it, it means you have an agenda. And that doesn't mean you have to believe in it. That's up to you. I mean, your faith is your personal belief. But if you want to dispute the Bible based on it being inaccurate and altered, well, you've got a lot to prove.
All right, so why don't we concede that it's, you know, relatively unaltered, or at least not to an extent that it would be worth, you know, diving into a whole rabbit hole about? Then what would you say to people that would just say, well, okay, it's legit, it's real, like maybe it wasn't altered that much, but it's still just what some ancient people wrote together to sort of try to do their best to describe their reality, because yeah, they didn't really know how things work like we do now.
Okay, I would say a couple things. First of all, if you want to say that the Bible is just written by men, and I want to say it was written by someone who, or was at least dictated to, or inspired by someone who was outside of time and space. Well, what's the proof that we have? Because both of us would have to present our proof. And hypothetically, your proof would be, well, you know, these are just a bunch of ancient guys who did this. They draw all this stuff down. And so it was just men. Well, then the proof is on me to show that this is a supernatural book. The only way I could prove that it's a supernatural book is if I could show that this book does something or presents something in a way that a regular mortal man couldn't, or does something that a mortal man couldn't or doesn't. And I believe the Bible does that. The Bible shows that it's transcendent because there are parts of the Bible called prophecy that tell the future before it actually happens. No human being is capable of doing that, or at least not reliably, not with 100% accuracy. So you have a book, for example, I'll give you the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel was written, and again, this is documented in through textual criticism, through aging, that the book of Daniel was written during the time of the Babylonian and the early part of the Persian Empire, under Darius and Cyrus and Artaxerxes. However, that book of Daniel accurately predicts the next three world empires a couple hundred years before they happened in detail. The book of Daniel talks about the next empire, the Grecian Empire. Well, first of all, it talks about how the Persian Empire was going to fall. It talks about how the Grecian Empire was going to come into power, and it would have a prominent king. And when that king died, his empire would be divided into four. And then that empire will be taken over by another empire that's even greater than that previous empire. And that, and during the time of that empire is when the Messiah, Jesus, would come into being. Again, these are prophecies that happened, that were predicted before they happened. Alexander the Great hadn't even been born yet. Yet Daniel said it would have this prominent king who would, after he died, would go into it would, his kingdom would be divided into four. What happened? Alexander the Great dies. He doesn't have any offspring. And on his deathbed, he says, "Give my empire to the strong." And it was divided between his four generals. How would a man know that 200 years before it happened? He wouldn't. How would he know that there would be another empire to follow it? And after that empire would be the time when the Messiah would come into existence. A normal human man wouldn't know that. You can even look at another one. It's the book of Isaiah. The book of Isaiah, in the book of Isaiah was written before the Babylonian captivity and the Persian captivity after that. Isaiah predicts that from God that these captivities were going to happen, but he also said that the Jewish people would be released by a leader named Cyrus. This was 223 years before Cyrus was born. Isaiah names him. It says it. Easily, you can look that up very easily. Go to your local Bible software and just put in the word Isaiah and the name Cyrus. How would he know this man's name before his grandparents were even born? And by the way, and Cyrus read this himself, and he was so impressed by it, he said, "Yeah, this must be the real God." And that's why he lets the Jewish people go out of the Persian Empire and allows them to go back to Israel and rebuild their temple. So, and of course, we have, you know, the prophecy and revelation where I'm doing, you know, my current series on YouTube. Mm-hmm. But that would be my point. That shows that this book does what no other religious or secular book has ever done, and that is predict things before they happen, showing that whoever inspired this book is outside of our physical time and space.
So you would say to the more skeptical people like that, I mean, perhaps they're just brushing things off, but they're, I'm assuming, not directly responding to the sort of things that you might point out, that maybe that's really the combination. It's the veracity of the document and the fact that we can see over time that, yeah, we do have older versions that confirm the newer versions are more or less what they are. And then combine that with the fact that what's in that very document could, over that span of time, could not have been written or sourced, I guess, with the information from anyone or any entity that did not exist outside of time and space for them to be this accurate. Is that sort of like, would that summarize, I guess, the case for the veracity of the Bible?
Yeah, I think that's one of them. Yes, or a couple of them, actually. I mean, yeah, those. So the two that I just went over are, I think, two of the strongest arguments for it. Because, again, is it possible that this all happened by accident? Yes, but I'm also, again, I'm a scientific thinker. I'm a mathematics thinker. So the probabilities, I would say, are extremely low. It's possible, but it's extremely unlikely that this just, that you know, these guys just guessed all these things before they happened.
I want to dive into or hop over a little bit to the evolution conversation a little bit, because I might have certain specific people in mind, but I've had these conversations many times in my life about this sort of thing. And there was probably a time when I would have been more partial to this evolution argument, or maybe something in between, because I think sometimes you'll even hear this sort of like, well, evolution is just, you know, it's just God doing this over millions of years or whatever it may be. But I think that's kind of just like sort of brushing aside all the problems with evolution, at least as it's presented generally. Of course, there's various, you know, evolutionary theories, but primarily discussing Darwin's theory. Right. What are the problems with that from a scientific perspective? Because it sounds like what you're describing and how the Bible really better describes what even science says, how science says things should be, even more so than the accepted scientific theory does, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. So I have a whole section on Faith by Reason about evolution. I mean, I think I have, you know, two or three episodes and podcasts and blogs on it. And here's the thing with evolution. If you want to believe it, go right ahead. I mean, it's, you know, it's a free country. You can believe whatever you want to believe. but it's not scientific. If you believe in evolution, you believe in it based on faith, because there is no part of it that has ever been empirically, scientifically proven. What is empirical science? Empirical science states that something is empirically, scientifically true if it can either be observed in nature or reproduced in a controlled or laboratory setting. There is no aspect of evolution that fits either of those paradigms. Let's look at some of the fundamentals of evolution, the things that have to be true in order for evolution to be true. You have to get life from non-life. You know, they basically, you know, to be flippant, it rained on rocks for 4 billion years and suddenly a cell sprang into life. Mm-hmm. You have to get life from non-life. Never been observed in nature, never been recreated in a controlled setting. In fact, they tried. In the 1950s, you had the Miller-Urey experiments where Stanley Miller tried to reproduce what was considered to be the primordial atmosphere of the Earth. You had, it was basically the Earth was covered in water, they call it a primordial soup. And in the atmosphere, there were several gases such as, methane and carbon dioxide and so forth and so on. And so the evolutionary paradigm is that, there were storms on the Earth at this time. Lightning struck these various these gases, nitrogen and methane and carbon dioxide and so forth. And that was a catalyst for them to form amino acids. Amino acids are the building block of protein. True. So then these amino acids would fall into the water. And over millions of years, you have basically this organic soup, as they call it. So you have all these amino acids in there bumping into each other, having a big old amino acid rave party. And eventually, these amino acids started joining together and forming a protein. Protein is a long chain of amino acids. These proteins are the building blocks of organic life. The proteins formed, just got together in some way and formed a first simple cell that was able to reproduce, take in nutrients and excrete waste. And that, and it went from there. So Stanley Miller, he gets basically a terrarium, for lack of a better term. He fills it with those gases, has water in the bottom to represent the ocean, and he would pass a spark through it to represent the lightning. And so he ran the spark through it, and then he examined what was in the water. And sure enough, there were some amino acids in the water. About 6% of it was amino acids. Problem is, about 80% of what he made was tar, which is toxic to life. The other 13% or so was certain acids, which would have made life impossible. Basically, if Stanley Miller had drank that fluid produced in the waters there, would have killed him. It was impossible, and it's been repeated so many times and failed every time that they don't even do it anymore.
So the one attempt to prove this in a laboratory environment actually created the most toxic environment that could never even stand a chance at sustaining life.
Yep, and it's easy research. Go to Google and Google the Stanley Miller, and I forget Urey's first name, but just Google Urey Miller experiments, and they'll tell you that's what happened. So you can't produce life from non-life. You can't have, and the next thing is that one species, other part of evolution, is that one species mutates into another species, not variation within the species. We're not talking about big dogs and little dogs, Chihuahua versus Great Danes. They're still the same species. No, we're talking, going from fish to amphibian to lizard to mammal to monkey to man. Never been observed in nature. There is no transitional form that anyone has ever observed. Not one. There's no animal turning into another species. There's no land animals slowly growing wings. There are no sea animals that are slowly growing lungs.
Well, I don't know, Ed. I've seen a bunch of documentaries where I've seen all these creatures, and the scientists, I don't know. I saw them with my own eyes. I've seen them in museums. I've seen them all over the place. Where are they coming from?
They come from animation studios.
They're coming from imaginations, right. I guess. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and when I talk about this in some of my podcasts on evolution, I talk about the amino acid thing. Because this, again, this is the foundation. Without this, there is no evolution. And so my question I ask people when we're going over our early Earth's atmosphere, my question, does it have oxygen or not? It's a binary question. Either it does or it doesn't. Either one makes it impossible. Let's say the ancient atmosphere did have oxygen in it. Well, oxygen, that would have instantly oxidized those amino acids in the sky, and that would have ruined them. Okay, let's say it didn't have oxygen. Okay, well then without oxygen, you don't have the ozone effect, which means ultraviolet radiation would have destroyed the amino acids. So somehow you have to have these amino acids existing in the atmosphere that does and does not have oxygen in it at the same time, because no matter what, whether it does or doesn't, it's going to destroy it all. But then here's the big one. Amino acids, they go into the water, they go into the oceans, and they start forming long chains that become proteins. Well, I think we all learned, and hopefully we learned this in high school chemistry, that when two molecules come together to form a chain, they give off some kind of byproduct as part of the joining. When they're joined together, something is lost in order for that bond to form. And if you want to break apart that bond, what you do is reintroduce that byproduct. So when two amino acids join together, what's produced? What's the byproduct? Something called H2O. We call it water. Meaning, if you want to break apart an amino acid bond, you introduce water. You know, go to your local health food store, buy some amino acid pills, drop them in water. They're going to break apart. So what did these amino acids fall into? The ocean. What is the ocean made of? Water. So you're telling me that amino acids fall into a gigantic pool of their own solvent and somehow they form bonds? That's impossible. Amino acids would never form that because they're in their own solvent.
It sounds like they didn't think this fit through very well, this primordial soup theory. They didn't really seem to even try to test it against their own sort of base assumptions and base knowledge.
Well, but what you find is that people will believe what you tell them. If you tell someone something, they will believe it and they won't question it. And so I say anyone who believes in evolution, that you either, one of three things: either you haven't studied it, or you have studied it and you just don't care, or you studied it and you don't care and you'd rather be right than be truthful. You know, you'd rather be right than have that actual knowledge.
A lot of times, evolution fans, I don't know if that's a term, but evolutionists, whatever you want to call them, will kind of just reply to something like that with just like, well, then explain this, and you see like bone, 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 or skull, 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 skull. You see different sort of, they're trying to say, look, this is something evolving, but what do you say to that when you see that kind of display of just like, you know, different versions of animals over time that they try to use as evidence that, look, no, this is occurring?
Because every one of those animals able to show me, if they can show me the complete skeleton, that animal is complete. It is not forming anything else. That would be like me getting, again, I give you the dog example. If I wanted to, I could show you the bones of a Chihuahua, then the bones of a Shih Tzu, and then the bones of a Golden Retriever, then the bones of a Mastiff, and a bone of the Great Dane. And I could say, you know what? This clearly shows evolution. You have this tiny dog becoming this big dog, except all those dogs exist right now. I see them in my neighborhood, but I'm walking my dog. All that proves that there are different types of the same species. Big dogs, little dogs, big cats, little cats.
And even if one type of that species were to evolve over time, and because of evolution and survival of the fittest, that version of it survives, then where are all the, like, why do the other versions still exist too? They should have died off because the superior one should be the one that's left, right?
Exactly. That's how it should be. But again, it doesn't really match reality. And, you know, the reason why if people are looking for the missing link, because it's missing. It's not there.
I guess that is where the term came from, right? Yeah. I mean, it's a term you hear from the time you're a kid, and you never think, well, if it's missing, how do we even know?
Yeah, we absolutely don't. And then we talk about mutations. There's no example in all of science of a beneficial mutation. Every mutation that's happened, it's two things. Number one, it's always been either, at best, it's been neutral. At worst, it's been detrimental. And the other thing is, our DNA is amazing in that it's self-correcting. Our DNA tends to correct a mutation in the next generation, especially if it's harmful. That's how our DNA is designed. If you have something, well, you don't necessarily pass it on to the next generation. You know, it happens sometimes, but generally, your DNA is trying to self-correct. And with evolution, if you do have a mutation that's wrong, the next generation would absolutely wipe it out so that you stick with the strongest genes. For example, I saw
Today's episode is sponsored by Fox & Sons Coffee. And let me just tell you, Steven of Fox & Sons, he is not just an advertiser. He has been a supporter of this show from day one. And frankly, since before day one, because he came over with me from the old Lions and Liberty days. So true fan of the show. He started this company, Fox & Sons, out of his love for coffee and really out of wanting to further bond with his sons and spend time with him, just like he shared time with his father drinking coffee. He also gets to teach his sons about entrepreneurship and business through this endeavor. So I'm so happy to have Steven and really his whole family, the Fox and the Sons, the whole gang, as a supporters and sponsors of this show. Not only that, his beans are so high quality, fresh. Look, I just got two new bags right here. I got the Mexican and my favorite, the Den Blend Dark. The beans are super high quality, fresh, and sourced from small organic farms. Fair trade. None of this GMO garbage. They're all small batch roasted. This is high quality stuff. Subscriptions are by far the best way to get your coffee. I have a couple subscriptions going, but that is the way to go. You never run out that way. I never run out. I always have my supply of Fox & Sons. So I want you to head over to foxandsons.com. Put in your order today. They ship fast. They ship now through the end of February. Also, by the way, you're going to get free shipping on any order over $37.99. By the way, while you're there, use discount code MCS to get 18% off any order over $25. Stephen Fox is a great man, a great friend, great supporter of the show. I encourage you to check out his coffee over at foxandsons.com.
A mutation of a cow that had a fifth leg. Now, that cow with a fifth leg wasn't faster than other cows.
Right.
That fifth leg was virtually useless, and it actually made it, it made it like very difficult for the animal to get around. If that animal wasn't being taken care of by a farmer, it would be easy prey for any predator out there. So that mutated leg didn't make it better, it made it worse. So no beneficial mutations. And again, and those mutations tend to really get wiped out in the next generation because our DNA tries to correct itself. It tries to keep us whole and complete. I mean, it's like having, you know, evolution says you have to have all these millions, if not billions, of beneficial accidents happening in a row. Now, just look in your normal life. How many times do you have a beneficial accident? Let's say, you know, I'm walking across my living room and I trip and fall.
Not often enough.
And I trip and fall and I look under my couch and I see a dollar. That's a beneficial accident because I tripped and I fell and I look under my couch. Oh, there's a dollar. Okay, how many of those will happen in a row? Not very often. Accidents are usually bad. That's why we call them accidents.
So what I want to get into is maybe a little bit of more of how you see the Bible's description of the creation of the universe and the creation of mankind fitting accurately, following reason and logic with like that sort of that scientific method that you've sort of criticized the evolutionary, you know, viewpoint with. Mm-hmm. How does that actually confirm what the Bible is saying, and how is the Bible sort of displaying it to us? Because it's not telling us these things in an academic way. It's obviously using a sort of different sort of format.
Good question. Thank you for asking that. So let's be clear about what the purpose of the Bible. Let's stick with the creation narrative in Genesis. Because I've had atheist friends of mine, actually a pretty good friend of mine who was an atheist. We worked together for a while, and he would say, you know, why aren't there dinosaurs in the Bible? Why wasn't the Bible talk about, you know, these different animals and all these things? I said, well, because the Bible is not a biology book. It's not intended. That's not what it was intended for. It wasn't intended to be a comprehensive treatise on everything that was created. If it was, if that was the point of Genesis, was to just give us a really hardcore scientific lesson on the creation of the universe, it does a terrible job of it. That's not what it was meant for. So understand the context of Genesis. Genesis was dictated, according to Christian philosophy, it was dictated to Moses by God, by Jehovah, for one reason: to separate his new nation of Israel from the other nations. Genesis is meant to the creation narrative in Genesis, the purpose of it is to contrast the true creation story with all the various narratives of the other cultures around Israel. So the only thing that's in the creation narrative is our contrastive statements. In other words, you may have heard your former captors in Egypt say that the universe was created by all these various gods, Osiris and Horus and Set and Thoth and all these people.
Ripping each other in half and, you know, eating each other's babies and all these All this wild stuff.
Exactly. But no, I'm telling you that I created it, and here's how I created it. So God didn't have to convince them that the world came into being supernaturally. They already knew that. But what they needed to be convinced of or understand was that it was the it was Jehovah who created it, and here's how he created it. So that's the first thing to understand, that it's not meant to be comprehensive. It's just meant to contrast the Judeo, well, there was no Christian at the time, the Hebrew God from the other gods.
It was meant to introduce the truth of our reality and the truth of the creation of mankind into this dialectic that it, where it wasn't there before, because they had only had the perspectives of whoever was telling them about, you know, gods ripping each other in half and all that.
Right, exactly. So that was the point of it. And then, as I said before, the when you get to the scientific level, the creation narrative, God speaking the world into existence, actually matches what we know about quantum physics, that, you know, it's energy and ordered vibrations. And then as far as when God spoke the species into existence, when he said, you know, he spoke the animals into existence and they reproduced after their own kind. What does that mean? That flies in the face of evolution. It says that one species become another. The Jehovah is saying that every species only reproduces after its own kind. Dogs will only make dogs. Cats will only make cats. Horses will only make horses. And that's kind of what we see. You know, we don't see... Yeah, I mean, you can make the argument of the, you know, of what donkeys and mules, so because but those are very clear, those species are very closely related, so that's how that can happen.
Yeah, give God one, all right, give God one. They're close enough. We're going to let that one go.
But in a very, very general sense, every species reproduces after its own kind, and that's what the Bible says. The Bible talks about a worldwide flood. Every culture has a worldwide flood. So. Or talks about a worldwide flood, but does it match with the actual truth of what we know about the flood? And then every culture has a mythology about the so-called gods coming down, having intercourse with women, and producing demigods. Well, you have in the Bible with the Nephilim, with the fallen angels coming down and having intercourse with the Nephilim. But what God is saying is, if I'm giving you truth, then believe my version of these things, because I'm the only one who's telling you this narrative in a way that matches reality. So it's not to say that that the Bible is the only place where there's a flood. No, I just said other cultures talk about a flood. The Bible isn't the only place that talks about how spiritual beings came down and had intercourse and produced hybrids. But what God is saying is that, yes, these things happen, but this is the correct version of it. That's the whole purpose of Genesis.
It's interesting to think of it in that way, that it's presented as a counter narrative to what's sort of already been laid out there and for what the world already sees. So therefore, it's not going to be presenting a counter narrative to evolution like we were discussing earlier, because that wasn't a narrative to be countered at the time. The narrative to be countered was all of this sort of, you know, Gnostic sort of worshiping of whoever they're worshiping. It's its own conversation we can maybe get into. But the point is the point was to introduce the truth through the Bible and through it being dictated to Moses, so that the true version of why these things have happened, of why things are the way they are, of why the flood happened. Like, because a lot of times you mentioned the flood, people will toss that back and they'll say, well, look, all these other books have the flood too. So that's just proof that they're all copying from each other. But you're saying, yeah, they all have the flood because it's real, because it happened. This is the version that's telling you, here's really why it happened. And whatever they're, you know, maybe they're not explaining that for you in Egypt or wherever else.
Exactly. So that gets back to, when we get back to the beginning and, you know, the world being made of energy and vibrations, that matches reality. Great. So if this is the only one that matches reality, then you should have some level of trust. Or faith, we can talk about what faith means. You should have some faith that if he got the beginning right, he probably get the rest of it right as well. And conversely, if the other ones are saying, you know, we formed the planets and the stars by, as you said, ripping somebody in half and spraying their innards into the sky, and that does not match reality, well, then they probably didn't get the rest of it right either. So God is saying, hey, trust, believe me, because what I'm saying matches what really happened. So that's what faith is. Faith, reasonable faith. Not blind faith. Reasonable faith is faith based on knowledge and or experience. You know, blind faith is believing something with no evidence at all. But that's not the faith that the God of the Bible asks of us. he says, whenever he says believe in me or do what I say, there's always a because. You know, believe me because I did this. Believe me because of what I told you before that was true. And all of us act on faith, whether you are a quote-unquote religious, spiritual person or not. If you're an atheist and you're driving down down a two-way highway, you have faith that the person coming towards you is going to stay in their lane. You don't know they are, but you have reasonable faith that, you know what, they probably don't want to kill themselves. So they're going to stay over there. And plus, I have experience driving down this road, and no one's ever veered into my lane before. Again, you don't know. What if that person's having a bad day? You know, just broke up with their spouse. You know, just got fired from their job and they're ready to end it all. It's possible, but there's a better than average chance that you both want to live. But there's an aspect of faith to it. Every time you sit in a chair, you have faith that's going to hold you. But it's reasonable faith based on your knowledge and experience of chairs. So that, but again, that's the faith that God asks of us. The God of the Bible asks for us is, you know, believe me based on your knowledge of me and your experience with me, not blindly. And we all exhibit that.
I think the way you describe that term, reasonable faith, really does sort of bridge a little bit of a gap for me, because it's not really saying just have the faith, because I think so many of the times when I was growing up trying to understand religion better, I would just run into the faith wall or be like, well, at some point you have to have faith. It's like, and I'd be like, well, I don't work that way. So sorry, now we're stuck. And that's where we are. So you are trying to really show that this concept of faith, of reasonable faith, it's not just blind faith. It's not faith. It's faith and then seeing that the faith does actually match reality. Now, that doesn't mean that you know 1,000,000%, maybe, because just like you don't know, the guy's not going to, that's driving towards you, is not going to hop over and just drive right into you. It could happen, but you have reasonable faith it won't, because reality generally does match it. That is, that he's not going to.
Exactly. I mean, we couldn't live without some matter of faith, because we don't know everything. I don't think I have to argue that point. We don't know everything. So anytime you do any new venture or even common ventures, we are doing it with the idea that things are going to work out. But again, it's based on our knowledge and experience. When I turn on my oven to cook something tonight, I don't know, there might be a gas leak somewhere and it's going to go poof and like explode everywhere. But I have the experience of that not happening in the hundreds of times I've turned on my oven. And I have knowledge that there are safety measures in place in the modern oven to keep that from happening. So I have a reasonable faith that when I turn on my oven, everything's going to work out fine. And it, in 99.9% of the time, it does. And that's enough faith that's enough faith for us to live on.
Sure. Especially when, as far as you know, you have like tons of friends and family who also have ovens, who also turn them on and their houses aren't burned down. It's like, okay, maybe you haven't checked the innards of the mechanics of every oven to know this, but you can generally look around and say, this matches with reality. And I think that's sort of maybe the crux of the Bible. It's not that the Bible, the way you describe it, is an owner's manual on reality, A to Z, but it does match reality when you really look at it and you try to line it up does this reasonably match what I'm actually seeing in the world? And I think that's a lot of what interested me more in the Bible and that sort of thing, because in the last 2 or 3 years or so, I saw a lot of things that just became more apparently evil, and I saw displays of evil in the world. So I started to say to myself, well, okay, if I'm really seeing the evil to be true, actually, there's this book and some people that have been following it that have been describing that evil for a long time. And actually, that's the only explanation that kind of makes sense. So in a way, I kind of have back-ended my way into some faith just by seeing that end of it and just saying, well, maybe there's actually people that have been saying this for a while, and a lot of this isn't really a mystery. A lot of our modern woes aren't so much of a mystery when we look at a source like this, even though it's not an owner's manual per se.
Right. I mean, and you're displaying reasonable faith by doing that. Does that mean you have to believe every single thing in the Bible? No, test it. And you should test it. You should not believe it blindly. If there's a part of the Bible that you don't understand, and there's still parts I don't understand. I don't want to, I know I come across as a know-it-all, but I don't know everything. There are parts of the Bible that confuse me that I don't fully get. But what I found over time, I get it more and more. And my faith is what I don't understand is not the Bible's fault. It's mine. I need to continue to grow. So if there are gaps there, my prayer is always show me what that means. You know, give me more knowledge. Help me understand those gaps. Because again, if I understand 60% of it, and 60% of it makes sense, then I can have faith, reasonable faith, that the other 40% makes sense too. It's just my job to work with it and find out how that other 40% does make sense.
Just one story that came to mind, you know, that you mentioned earlier, and this is just one that often comes up though, but it, you know, it's one of these things, like when we talk about the flood, or so as we mentioned earlier. So a lot of people will read the Bible or see that part of the Bible or hear about it and say, well, how could a loving God? And I'm curious your answer, because I actually just had a whole conversation about this topic with L.A. Marzulli the other week. So, but I'm curious the way you perceive it, like that people say, how could a loving God just come in here and just, you know, mass murder people essentially? And this is one that always confounded me as a child growing. I went to Hebrew school. I was raised Jewish. So, I mean, I only got the Old Testament stuff, but that was when I was like, I don't know, man. I don't know if this guy's, he seems like he's got a bit of a temper, man. Like maybe he's not. And I do wonder if too, some of those stories are presented minus the proper context, because they don't want you to have the proper context for whatever reason.
Yeah. So I'll give you a quick answer and then I'll break it down some. Why would a loving God commit genocide to a bunch of people, through a bunch of human beings? The answer is he didn't. The flood did not kill. And this, again, this is a little bit of conjecture, but I think there's strong biblical precedent, and I'll explain what I mean by that. No human beings died in the flood. The flood only killed the Nephilim. Mm. Here's why I'm saying that.
That is not the way they teach us that at all.
Mark, it's not what I was taught either. This was, you know, I for most of my life, I was taught that, you know, it was because there were bad people and God wanted to kill all the bad people. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, my response is, then there should be a flood like every 50 years.
The
flood is just based on us screwing up as human beings.
My house should be flooded for what I did in my 20s. I mean, geez.
I need to live on a boat. That's the only way I would get through it, because I screw up all the time too. In Genesis chapter 6, it talks about the Nephilim, that, you know, the sons of God, the B'nai HaElohim. I'm sorry for me butchering the Hebrew. These were what we call angels, or more accurately, the Elohim, because angel or angelos is Greek, means messenger. It's a job title. Elohim is what is the term. It's translated God, G-O-D, but it just basically means you are someone who inhabit the spiritual realm. They're basically two intelligent life forms. There is the spiritual beings and there's humanity. If you dwell in the spiritual realm, you are an Elohim. God, Jehovah, is an Elohim, but he's obviously the highest ranking Elohim, but he's Elohim because he dwells in the spiritual realm. If you dwell in the material realm, you are called man. So those are the two, Elohim, man. So I want to make sure that's clear, because some people will accuse me of believing in multiple gods. No, I believe in the Elohim, and I believe that there are men. And so it's like me saying I'm an American, but that's not my name. That's just where I dwell. And, you know, the president of the United States, also an American, just has a different level of authority. So so the Elohim came down. They decided, for their reasons, which is a whole huge thing, but their reasoning, but they decided they wanted to mate with women and produce hybrids. They basically wanted to have their own version.
Which actually was the one thing, as we talked about earlier, that all the species aren't supposed to do. They're supposed to just be with each other's species. And they're throwing that thing out of the window. They're like, no, forget that. We're gonna do something a little different.
They wanted their own version of humanity. They wanted a better version. God made Adam and Eve, spiritual, material hybrids. We have flesh and we have a soul. They wanted their own version of flesh with a soul. And these were the Nephilim. So, but to get to my point, when it talks about, so they filled the earth with violence. If you read the pseudepigraphal Book of Enoch, which is not part of the biblical canon, I believe you can make a strong argument that it should be, but it gives more details on this. And it says that these Nephilim, they were giants. They were literal giants. They consumed all the produce of men. Then when men could no longer sustain them, they started eating men. They started cannibalizing human beings. Then, and so they were basically just wiping out humanity. And it says in the book of Genesis 6 that Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. That term perfect refers to in Hebrew a physical blemish. He was lacking any physical blemish. He was a pure human being. So by contrast, I think Jehovah's basically saying that Noah and his family were by this time, after about 1,000+ years of the Nephilim on earth, Noah and his family were the only pure human beings left.
And when you say pure, you mean as in not tainted with Nephilim blood or Nephilim bloodlines in some way?
Right, exactly. So the only life left on the earth by the time of the flood was Noah, his three sons, their wives, and the Nephilim.
And a bunch of wild
stuff. Yeah. That's why he sent the flood, to wipe out the Nephilim, because they would have made humanity extinct. There was only one family left, and God preserved them. So, yeah, that's a little out there. But if you read the works of, you know, some really good scholars in the Semitic languages, like the late Dr. Michael Heiser, who I'm a, you know, really big fan of, he talks about this in detail about how the language shows that, yeah, he was contrasting Noah's genetics with the genetics of the rest of the world. Everyone was tainted. And so he had to preserve humanity in order for his plan to continue. And so that's why the flood happened and wiped everyone else out.
And then, you know, what someone's more skeptical of this story in the first place might say is, well, why did God even allow it to happen in the first place? Why would God even allow the Nephilim to come in and, you know, take women and create these hybrids? Why let it get so bad before saying, oh, I guess I just got to wash this whole thing clean?
Because God gave us free will. And by giving us free will, there's a consequence to that. By giving people the option to make choices, meaning they can make the wrong choice. And the other thing to keep in mind is on the seventh day of creation, when it said, you know, on the seventh day, God rested. It's not because God was tired. That's not what it meant. When it says God rested, it says God ceased his activity. What activity? Mm-hmm. He ceased his activity of being the first cause, of initiating his will unilaterally. After Genesis chapter 2, God, Jehovah, never initiates his will. From Genesis chapter 2 all the way to the end, from the end of chapter 2 to the end of the Bible, he only responds. He gave that initiation of will over to Adam when he said, I made you my image. You bear my image. You are now in charge of creation here. I just want to walk with you in the cool of the day, as we see in Genesis chapter 3. So God's whole purpose was, Adam, Eve, you're the king and queen of the earth. Be fruitful, multiply, make the earth into Eden. And in the evening, in the cool of the day, let's walk and talk and share. That's, when you get down to it, that's really God's plan. That was his original plan.
Just wanted to have the buddy.
People. Yeah. The only reason to create other intelligences is if you want to have other perspectives and hear other stories and get other experiences. That's why he created the Elohim and man. So he can only respond, and he only responds in response to justice. God is, Jehovah is always and completely right and just. He's 100% righteous, 100% just. So it would be unjust for God to initiate his will against us without our, I want to say without our consent. It would be unrighteous for him to initiate his will on us until we've made a hard choice. For example, I'll hear someone say, well, you know, why doesn't God, and here's the classic one, why doesn't God stop evil? Why doesn't God stop a murderer? Let's play this out. Let's say Mark, I decided, you know what? I can't stand Mark Claire. I'm going to murder him. Mm-hmm. When is it just for God to stop me? Can he stop me when I decide I want to kill you? No. Why? Because I could change my mind. What if I go to the store and buy a gun? Can he stop me then? Nope. I can still change my mind. What if I get that gun, I go to your front door and knock on your door and point the gun right in your face? Can he stop me then? I can still change my mind. Okay. What about when I fire the bullet? Why doesn't God just slap the bullet out of the air? Well, if we all knew that God slaps bullets out of the air, is it really a choice? I'm like, I'll just shoot at Mark. I'm not going to hit him anyway.
God always takes care of this. It's fine.
Yeah. So God cannot stop us from doing it. What he can do is respond in justice. And if you have a problem with that, then you have a problem with our entire justice system, because our entire justice system is based on the same thing. You punish a crime after the crime is done. You know, aside from that, what was that movie with Tom Cruise back in the day, Minority Report, where they had this thing called pre-crime, where they have these psychics who would tell them what was going to happen. Before. Yeah, right. Precogs, right. But that's a fantasy. In reality, it is unjust to punish someone for a crime before they commit the crime. And God's the same way. So there will be justice. So we wonder, why do people get away with things? They're not getting away with it. They will be judged either in this lifetime or the next. But if God stopped you before you committed an injustice, then God would be unjust by doing that. You can't punish someone for doing something until they do it.
And so I guess the idea is that the creation of man was the act, and then it's kind of like hands off. It's like, you know, because otherwise, if I'm just going to constantly change what they're doing because I don't like it, well, then I'm not really creating that buddy, or so to speak. I'm not actually creating somebody new to learn from, because I'm just creating carbon copies of exactly what I think should be done and what I think, you know, how I think the world should play out. But really, for man to struggle and man to overcome things, man has to make all these mistakes and man has to kind of F things up, I guess.
And learn from them and hopefully grow from them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the whole thing. And that's why, you know, they have, when you get to the end of the book of Revelation, they have something called the, right before eternity, you have the great white throne judgment, where everyone who has not taken advantage of the provision that God made for, you know, the rectification of sin, and thus we get into Jesus and the sacrifice on the cross. Anyone who chose not to do that, well, then you have to pay for your own sins. You have to. So that's why, no matter how good you think you are, you can't be in God's presence by just being quote unquote good. You have to be perfect. God cannot have imperfection. He cannot have darkness in his presence at all. So there are three ways to be in God's presence. One, you could live a completely sinless life. You can just make every right choice from the moment you're born to the moment you die, never do anything wrong. Then, hey, there you go.
Which is quite literally impossible for humans.
Quite literally impossible. Yeah. Number two is you can do the best you can and say, you know what, I think I'll do it on my own. I'll be good enough. Well, good enough isn't perfect. Or you can take the provision that God provided by sending his son to live the perfect life that none of us could, and then to die unjustly so that we could get that provision. Basically, here's the thing. The only person who never deserved to die, If the wages of sin is death, which is one of the verses in the Bible, then the only person who never deserved to die would be someone who never sinned. Jesus never sinned. And the reason he never sinned was because he was God. How was he God? Was it because, you know, he was, you know, born of God and of Mary? No, that would make him half and half. No, the reason he was God, because he had the nature of God. The nature of God was to be always a completely right and just. And Jesus said specifically, he only did what the Father, what Jehovah told him. That's what he said, you know, blatantly, I only do what God tells me. So I'll hear people say, well, could Jesus have sinned? Well, theoretically, he could. Jesus had two arms and two legs, so he could have walked up to someone and just punched him out. He had that capability of doing that. But because he gave his will completely over to God, he couldn't sin because he didn't do anything on his own. I look at it like a video game. When you're playing whatever video game you play, Mario Brothers, Halo, that avatar only does what you tell it to do. Now, it's capable of doing anything in that environment, but you're in control of it. So it's not going to do anything you don't tell it to do. So Jesus was God's avatar. So he only did what God told him to do. And that's why he lived a perfect life. So he should have lived forever. So by justice, he should have eternal life, infinite life. But he was killed unjustly. So if you were killed unjustly, the only just thing to do would be to give you back life. How much life? Infinite life, because he should have lived infinitely. So if you were given back infinite life, you can share that life infinitely with anyone else. And that's how Christians, people who believe in the gift that Jesus gave us, that's how we can have sharing that life, because he had infinite life to give us. So that's me being my systems thinker and making it make sense. That's how one man's death could pay for all of our sins.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard it explained in quite that way. That there was kind of a click there with me. Like I never really heard it in that sense of like, because I've always heard over and over, like, yeah, Jesus died for the sins, so now we can, like, okay, but I still never got like, why? Like, why did that do that? Why couldn't he have just not done that? And that is a really interesting way to look at it. That if it's a recompensation of justice in a sense, and the reward or the compensation is infinite life, that's the offer then, that he can share that because it's infinite. So if it's infinite for him, it could be infinite for us.
Right. And so, wow. So the other way, you can accept that, which I've done, and hopefully, you know, as many people as possible do as well. But if you don't, then when you stand before him at final judgment, whose fault is it? You know, all you can say is, you know, I did my best. He said, great. But again, the internal judgment won't be the same for everyone. You know, a nice little old lady who just decided, you know what, I just don't believe it. I'm going to live a nice life. I'm going to be a good person. But I just don't believe in God. She's not going to have the same level of punishment as a Hitler or a Jeffrey Dahmer or a Jeffrey Epstein.
I would hope not. Yeah.
No, they're not. I mean, that's why people say, well, why would a nice person who's an atheist go to the same hell as
the, the random tribe in the jungle sort of example, like that's never heard about Jesus or never heard of any of this stuff, yeah. You know?
And I have an answer for that too. I think I talked about this, I think it was on the Sam Tripoli show. I was on there a few months ago. Mm. Here's the thing about that, because that bothered me for a long time too. You know, what if they've never heard of them, of God? The truth is everyone's heard of God. Maybe you haven't read the Bible, but understand that God knows your heart. And there are five things that everyone knows, no matter whether you read the Bible or not. One thing you know is that there is good and evil in the world. Everyone knows that. Everyone also knows that they're not completely good. Everyone knows that they do bad things. Everyone also knows that whatever transcendent good there is outside of them. They know that all these so-called tribes in the jungle, they aren't atheists. They know that there is a greater power out there, and that power is good. And they know that they are not that good. They know that. So if that person, that tribesman in wherever, says, I'm not good on my own, and they appeal to whatever that source of good is that they know exists and says, I can't be good on my own, help me, they've just prayed what we call the sinner's prayer. They've just said, I'm a sinner. I'm not good. I need you to make me good. Please do it. And I believe that God will honor that. And what's my biblical basis for that? Well, because remember, Jesus was born in the first century. There were people who lived before that, who God called righteous. Noah, Abraham, David, so forth, and even people who aren't necessarily the big heroes of the Bible, people like Rahab, who was a harlot, a prostitute in Jericho. She wasn't a saint at all, but she knew that she was wrong and that the God of the Bible was right when she helped. I mean, you said she went to Hebrew school, so you know the story of, you know, the walls of Jericho and what she did. She was righteous because she appealed to that higher power that she knew was good. And she's considered, she's in the lineage of Jesus. She's honored for that. So that's biblical proof right there that if you acknowledge your place in the world, God's place in the world, and that you need him, then he will honor that and it will be accounted to you righteous. In the book of Hebrews, it says that, you know, Abraham believed in God and it was accounted to him righteous as righteousness. So that shows right there that even before Jesus, they had no knowledge of him. Noah didn't know who Jesus was, but he knew enough to follow God, and that was accounted to him. That was put, you know, literally like an account. It was put into his ledger that this guy's righteous. And I believe that God will honor that with anyone who does it in the world, whether you've been in a church or seen a Bible or not. Because that would be just.
Well, Ed, really interesting conversation. Like we discussed before the show, you know, it's hard to know where to start or where to contain conversations like this because there's just so much to get into. So my only hope is that I could just interest people in what you're doing enough that if they think this conversation was interesting, they'll go dive a little further. So I'll just let you give everybody the roundup of we mentioned, you know, the Rumble, the YouTube, but anything else you want to mention on the way there. And of course, we're going to dive a little bit deeper in a minute. We're going to hop into the smoke-filled room. So we'll see. We'll get into some more fun in there.
Sure. So my website, best place to reach me is faithbyreason.net, not .com, .net. And I would say most of the things I talked about, you'll find there's hundreds of hours of material there. But I talked about with, you know, Jesus and salvation, and the whole infinite life thing. I talk about that there, the Nephilim and Noah, all that stuff is there in my blogs and podcasts there. Also my YouTube channel, also Faith by Reason. I'm doing a Revelation series, which I'm almost done with. I'm actually have two episodes to go. I just finished recording my second to last episode. So if you're interested in that fascinating book, I have 60 episodes there for you. So it's a super deep dive there. It's also on my Rumble channel. And after that, I'll be doing a series on the book of Genesis. So go to faithbyreason.net, go to the Start Here button, and you'll be taken step by step through a systematic analysis of Christian philosophy. And, you know, give me your comments. I'd love to hear them. And, you know, I'm just here to help. I'm not here to make money. If I do, that'd be great. But I'm just, I want to make sure that people who are on the same journey as I am on will benefit from the knowledge that I've been given. And I just want to help.
Well, Ed, I certainly find your approach really, really fascinating. Like I said in the beginning of the show, it's really an approach that has helped fill a lot of gaps of my own methodology and then a lot of the walls that I've gotten into over the years. So I'm definitely going to continue to follow your work, encourage everybody else who found this conversation interesting to do so, and I encourage those same people to sign up for the Mark Claire Show Premium. Come on, hop into the smoke-filled room with us. Ed, thanks so much for coming on my show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, friends, I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. And remember, if you're listening here on the public feed, that means you're only getting about 2/3 of the conversation because every one of these interviews goes approximately 30 minutes longer in what is called the Smoke-Filled Room bonus segment. To get the complete version of every episode, just become a subscriber to The Mark Claire Show. You can do so on Patreon, on Subscribestar, on Rockfin. You can find all the links you need over at markclaire.com. That's markclaire, markclaire.com. Until next time, my friends, in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. Today's episode is sponsored by Fox & Sons Coffee. And let me just tell you, Steven of Fox & Sons, he is not just an advertiser. He has been a supporter of this show from day one. And frankly, since before day one, because he came over with me from the old Lions and Liberty days. So true fan of the show. He started this company, Fox & Sons, out of his love for coffee and really out of wanting to further bond with his sons and spend time with him, just like he shared time with his father drinking coffee. He also gets to teach his sons about entrepreneurship and business through this endeavor. So I'm so happy to have Steven and really his whole family, the Fox and the Sons, the whole gang as a supporters and sponsors of this show. Not only that, his beans are so high quality, fresh. Look, I just got two new bags right here. I got the Mexican and my favorite, the Den Blend Dark. The beans are super high quality, fresh and sourced from small organic farms, fair trade. None of this GMO garbage. They're all small batch roasted. This is high quality stuff. Subscriptions are by far the best way to get your coffee. I have a couple subscriptions going, but that is the way to go. You never run out that way. I never run out. I always have my supply of Fox & Sons. So I want you to head over to foxandsons.com. Put in your order today. They ship fast. They ship now through the end of February. Also, by the way, you're going to get free shipping on any order over $37.99. By the way, while you're there, use discount code MCS to get 18% off any order over $25. Stephen Fox is a great man, a great friend, great supporter of the show. I encourage you to check out his coffee over at foxandsons.com.